Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is Orlando Harrison. Orlando Harrison is a musician, writer, and sound artist with roots in radical conceptual art. He is known for his work with bands such as the Alabama Three, Miasma, and the Carousel of Headless Horses, and the Daughters of God. He is also producer of The Wrong Show, a surreal radio series, which was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM approximately 3 years ago and ran to 13 episodes. He has performed numerous sound works over the last 10 years on Resonance Radio, Reverb Radio, and at venues including Hag Night, The Horse Hospital, and Poltroon, a literary salon which he ran for 3 years in Clerkenwell. His work is concerned with the human voice and its manipulation. He is currently artist in residence at Senate House Library. Good afternoon, Orlando.
Good afternoon, William. thanks for having me.
That's all right. Thank you very much for coming in. Now, we should start at the beginning.
Okay. Do you want my previous lives, previous incarnations?
Indeed. If you have memories of any previous, I can imagine that you possibly have, well, yes, have something.
How long have we got? An hour? I mean, I was a Nubian slave in the year 3000 BC. That was quite a story there.
You were?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
Pretty rough, actually, yeah.
Well, I can imagine, yes. Yeah. But you survived that, and now you've re-emerged.
I've re-emerged into this current incarnation.
Okay.
As a skinny, white, middle-aged, middle-class male.
You're not, you're not middle-aged yet. Come on.
I am. I feel it.
All right. Now, I'm going to start at Nubian slaves to one side. You are the son of Charles Harrison, co-founder and member of the influential conceptual art group Art and Language.
I am, yes. Well, yes, when you said I had roots in radical conceptual art, that makes me sound like an incredibly subversive and important conceptual artist, which I would like to be. But no, that's referring to...
To your father.
To my father and his history and his...
Indeed.
The group that he worked with, who were known as Art and Language, who were a collective of artists.
Yeah.
At the beginning, they were a collective. Now there's just two of them.
Okay. Who's left?
Michael Baldwin and Mel Ramsden.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I have actually played numerous records of theirs over the years because they sort of collaborated with the Red Crayola, didn't they, quite a lot?
That's right. Mayo Thompson. Well, when you say collaborated, you know, in terms of the collective, you can say Mayo Thompson was in Art and Language, although on the records it always said Red Crayola plus Art and Language.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was in the nature of Art and Language in those days that it was a very loose group in the nature of a kind of radical political organisation or a terrorist cell. It had a large floating membership.
They weren't really a terrorist cell.
Well, there were similarities. I mean, you know.
Okay.
In the
I hear sirens.
Well, I mean, you could argue, I don't want to put any words in anybody's mouth, but you could argue that their fundamental aim was the complete and utter overthrow of Western capitalism.
Well, that's just revolutionary socialism, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. Again, I'm going to get into trouble here for talking ex-cathedra. If anybody who tries to make claims on... behalf of Art and Language or to characterise our ideological position tends to get into very sticky territory. So I'm going to be very careful. But certainly they had, a dissident attitudes towards the prevailing order, should we say.
Okay. So your dad was Charles Harrison, who I should say he died I think in 2009.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. And he was an art historian and critic.
Yeah.
And when did he get attached to Art and Language then?
Well, he studied at the Courtauld Institute and very quickly under Anthony Blunt, by the way.
Oh, right. The famous, the plot thickens.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. The famous Soviet spy and also keeper of the Queen's pictures.
Absolutely.
I always wondered if if his secret communist leaning somehow influenced my dad in his, the direction of his career, because he went from being kind of an establishment figure to someone who is kind of, in some ways, working ideologically against the status quo.
Yeah.
But, he after he graduated, he became a curator and started putting on exhibitions. He was a champion of early conceptual art in Britain.
Yeah. I noticed that he curated the British section, I think, of When Attitudes Become Formed.
That's right, yeah.
Which was a sort of touring show, which was originally, I think it was originally curated by Harold Zeman in Switzerland. And then it sort of toured, didn't he? But your dad seems to have been responsible somehow for the ICA manifestation of this.
That's right. And he got a lot of British artists involved, like, I'm trying to remember names, Ian Byrne and, what's his name? The guy who
Victor
did...
Victor Bergin.
Victor
was
Bergin.
He part of it?
Yeah. And who's the guy that did... he did stuff with the hair. He did amazing sculptures, with kind of spotty sculptures. Barry Flanagan, that's it.
Oh, yeah.
Barry Flanagan, yeah.
Right.
And, yeah, he's very much responsible for
and he's written about art and language consistently over several decades, I think.
Yeah, well, the way he described it to me, you know, he had a thrusting and brilliant career as a young curator, and rapidly became very disillusioned and kind of burnt out by the art world and its kind of vicissitudes and its venality, should we say. I think he felt at some point that he was kind of in the middle of it, although he was being very successful as a curator in fashionable 60s London, he was kind of losing a bit of his soul. You know?
Right.
And I think...
so this was the environment that you grew up in? I mean, was it sort of...
This is around the time of my birth.
Right.
And I think meeting art and language kind of saved him, because these were guys that had a very critical position as a response to the art establishment. And I think in conjunction with them, it helped him find a place where he could do some real work. You know?
Right. So, and art and language, strangely, produced various records over the years. I mean, I say strangely, they are quite an acquired taste, I think. They're quite eccentric music, don't you think?
Yeah, it's certainly not easy listening. And
it's like sort of they're often 3-minute tracks. They sound ostensibly like kind of not exactly rock and roll, but it's a kind of but with, I don't know, political lyrics with a sort of like a guitar and drums and so on.
Yeah,
but quite often not very tuneful, shall we say?
Right, whether design or by accident.
Yeah.
I mean, they certainly weren't trying to produce slick pop music. You know, yeah. This was definitely...
And I've brought in the first one. I've got the cover here somewhere in this pile. Their first LP was called Corrected Slogans, and that's Art and Language and the Red Crayola. It first came out in 1976, and I've actually got the second edition vinyl, which is about, I think it's 1981 or 1982. And... you informed me that you actually feature on one of these tracks on this 1976 conceptual art album, aged 8.
I think about 8 years old, yeah. actually singing touchingly with my dad and my mum are both also on that track. It's three people, it's a trio.
Right. Who was your mother?
My mum took the voice of Harriet Martineau, who was a kind of Victorian lady social reformer and early feminist, and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the poet.
So that's what the track is called, Coleridge versus Martineau.
Yeah.
But was your mother an artist?
She taught...
Is your mother an artist?
She's taught art history. She's not an artist, really. She's a historian.
Okay.
But she was involved. She was involved with art and language, and actually she wrote... a couple of pieces for the magazines. I mean, everybody was involved, you know.
Yeah.
It was a big, happy, slightly cultish family.
What's your mother's name?
Sandra Harrison.
Sandra Harrison. Yeah. Okay. So this is Sandra Harrison, Charles Harrison and Orlando Harrison singing together on Coleridge, Coleridge versus Martineau.
Yes.
Should we just play this track then?
Sure.
Coleridge once said to Harriet Martineau, who's injuring art society as a congeries of individualities, to which she replied,
for freedom equals personalities.
A non-meeting of minds is the permanent legacy that finds history in the encounter.
Something's made Coleridge transfer to the biologically impeded, but nobody superseded Harriet Martineau.
Happiness equals freedom equals personality.
She has similarly replied to those on the other side.
Is that the end of that track?
That's the end. It's quite a short track.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. I could certainly pick your voice out there.
Yeah. Well, you'll notice, I hope my mother won't mind me saying this, but she's not the world's best singer. You know, she's, you know, you can see she had a little trouble keeping the tune there. I remember as we were driving to this studio and she was desperately trying to nail this song. And that particular line, happiness equals freedom equals personality. Yeah. See, I can't get it anymore. I can't get up there.
No, but they're all a bit like that, aren't they? Yeah, I think all the art and language tracks are kind of like, it's like people struggling to make music.
Yeah, well, certainly, Michael explained to me once with a lot of those tracks, he sort of tried to set an impossible limits, you know, to produce things that were sort of pop songs but had this incredibly dense and verbose vocabulary to them.
Right.
To write an impossible song, if you like. That was kind of the...
Do you remember the recording session?
I do. I remember it very well. Yeah?
Yeah. Where was it?
It was a little studio. It would have been somewhere near... somewhere near Wallingford where we lived. I remember it wasn't very far from the house.
So you lived out in the country and it's Oxfordshire?
Is
it Berkshire?
That would have been Buckinghamshire.
Buckinghamshire, okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Wallingford. Yes. Wallingford, yeah. Little town. Yeah.
All right. Well, was this your first experience of music then? This kind of interaction with your parents? I mean, because you then went on to form a band and join a band. You've had a career in music sort of ever since, really.
I suppose I have, yeah. I mean, it was certainly exciting, that first experience in the studio. I suppose maybe I did get some kind of bug then.
Yeah. All right, so this brings us up to the Alabama Three, I suppose, which is it's a band you tour with. Most people would know, well, I'm being a bit presumptuous, but I think most people know the Alabama Three.
Most people of a certain age probably know it.
For the theme tune to The Sopranos.
Right, yes. Yeah.
Woke up this morning, which I'm possibly not going to play because you'd rather I didn't.
If you really want to, you can play 10 seconds of it.
I'll save that. I'll save that then. Right. So we could play.
Everybody's
heard it. Tell me a bit about the Alabama Three. How did you start in this? You play with several bands, don't you? Something called the Divine. I almost called it Divine Horsemen after the Maya Deren film. But
yes.
I'm looking for the names of your other bands, but perhaps you can help me out.
Yeah, you're thinking of Miasma and the Carousel of Headless Horses. Very,
right.
Very snappy name there.
Yeah.
That was a couple of years ago. We did one album with them, very interesting stuff, kind of gothic prog rock, not the kind of stuff I'd usually do, but it was... it was fun and stretching, and yeah, I think we reached some interesting territory with that stuff.
You did a tour of the UK before Christmas with the Alabama Three.
Alabama Three, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
You've got another one coming up in April, I think.
We do, yeah.
So you must have a following. You've obviously got a following of.
We do. We have a loyal grassroots following, as they say.
Yeah.
Mainly of middle-aged alcoholic divorcees. luckily, those guys, they do have a certain amount of disposable cash, so they keep the band going.
Do they identify with you somehow?
they do, not me personally. But, we've got a loyal following.
Right.
It's I think we give...
So first of all, I mean, we have to... It's called the Alabama Three.
Yeah.
Have any of you been to Alabama?
We have. I don't think anybody had been to Alabama by the time when we formed the band.
Right.
So in a way, we made Alabama come to us.
Yeah.
You know, by,
okay. And how many people are in the band?
Currently, I think there's 11, 12, 10.
All right. You know. Do you want to name the other members? Who are the founder members of the band?
Founder members, Rob Sprague, otherwise known as Larry Love. Jake Black, otherwise known as D-Wayne Love. Piers Marsh, who's no longer with the band, known as okay. Mountain of Love. And Eddie Reel, who's... what was his sobriquet? Conga Man Love.
Well, what's your sobriquet?
I am the Spirit of Love.
The Spirit of Love.
Yes.
Okay. And you play keyboards?
I do, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
This name was thrust upon me. I didn't choose it. I want to point out... Although I do quite like it.
So we're going to skip over. We're not going to play "Woke Up This Morning," anyone who followed The Sopranos would remember that opening track because it's a great track actually, and it really has a feeling.
It's not bad.
Wherever it was, New York or whatever, but
New Jersey,
New Jersey.
Yeah.
Okay, so should we play a different track off this? You've brought in a double vinyl of the Alabama Three.
Yeah.
We could perhaps get a flavour of the group by playing this track, which is what? Something about Mao Zedong.
Mao Zedong said.
Mao Zedong said. Okay, well, let's listen to that.
Love has practically caused me to just get you destroyed. If I had hated a little more, just a little more, we would have had a little less trouble. Because I look at my thoughts differently. Sure, you got love. Principle! But don't say, hate is my enemy. What do they say? What's that word? Hate is my enemy. I got to fight it day and night. One of the others is lying. Love's the only weapon. Shit! Bullshit! Martin Luther King died with love! I got the fight. I got a hell of a lot of weapons to fight. I got my claws. I got compasses. I got guns. I got dynamite. I got a hell of a lot to fight. I'll fight. I'll fight. I will fight. Let them hear it in the night.
We know what they are, so let Mao Zedong be your guiding star. And pick up the gun, learn how to fight all through the day and all through the night. Till come the day when the last fight's won. I want you to listen, son, cause Mao Zedong said change must come through the barrel of a gun. I want you all to listen, son. Listen, son, change must come. Change must come through the barrel of a gun.
Outside, you know. All of a sudden I'm overcome by a feeling of brief mortality. Cause I'm getting on in the world, coming up on 41 years. 41 stony grave steps towards the grave. You know, the box awaits its grisly load. Now I'm gonna be food for worms. And just like Charles Mingus wrote that beautiful piece of music epitaph for Eric Dolphy, I say, so long, Eric. So long, John Coltrane and Charles Mingus. So long, Duke Ellington and Lester Young. So long, Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald. So long, Jimmy Reed. So long, Muddy Waters. And so long, Howlin' Wolf.
Okay, well, that's the one with the long build-up.
Yes, yes. I can't believe you actually managed to get that, sneak that in.
Yeah. I had to. I really like it. I used to love the beginning of The Sopranos. Right. I know you maybe tried to play it down somewhat.
I've heard it so much. I shouldn't be churlish because that song's been good to us. If it wasn't for that one song, then the band wouldn't have... I don't think we'd have kept going for the next.
What were you telling me about Jim Jones and this other track?
On the front of Mousy Tongue said that was the voice of Jim Jones, the notorious Marxist Christian apostolic preacher, and cult leader who preached a strange mixture of communism and Christianity, and managed to persuade all his followers that they were bound for Venus. Ended up by killing his entire congregation of several thousand people with Kool-Aid laced with strychnine and acid, I think.
Right.
What a way to die.
Yeah. And so that was the voice we heard at the beginning.
That was Jim Jones,
track. That is still going.
That's the noise of the congregation actually dying, I believe. That's a recording we got from the archives of Psychic TV. Thank you, Genesis Peorage.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, perhaps we should move on now to your present role. So that was the Alabama 3. And we are talking to Orlando Harrison, co-founder member of the Alabama 3?
I'm part of this, what you might say is the second wave.
Second wave of Alabama
3. I'm one of the new boys. I've only been in the band for 19 years.
Okay. So now we should get on to your present role as artist in residence at Senate House Library.
Right.
Can you explain a bit about what your position is there?
I have been... tasked with sitting in a little glass office and trying to come up with some interesting ways to illustrate or dramatise or whatever the exhibition that's currently on there called Radical Voices.
Right.
And that's based around Senate House's large collection of radical, left-wing, progressive literature, pamphlets, letters, posters...
Is this the Ron Heisler collection?
The Ron Heisler collection is a big part of it, yeah.
Right, okay, but not the whole thing. That's just a part of it.
It's an important part of it, but not the whole thing.
I only mention that because we both sort of have an acquaintanceship with Ron.
We do,
As a book collector.
Right.
collector and book buyer, book dealer. Well, he's not a dealer as such because he just seems to give all of his stuff away.
Right.
I think he donated something like 40,000 items to Senate House Library, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Okay, and this is an ongoing project, I think. Have there been two or three artists already?
Hannah Thompson, who was actually on one of your previous shows,
yep.
Was artist in residence before me. She was actually there for a year. I'm only there for 3 months. And she did an amazing project based around the building itself, collecting ambient recordings, doing things like really clever geeky stuff, like have sound controllers being modulated by the atmospheric pressure in the building, like really...
Gosh, you know, okay. The building itself is quite extraordinary, isn't it? Wasn't it used as a set for the Ministry of Information in 1984?
Yeah, well, it was actually more than a set. It was the basis for the Ministry of Truth in 1984.
Right.
The place where Winston Smith works and erases his... fellow citizens from the historical record.
Right.
Yes, it was. It's an amazing, quite imposing Art Deco building. Anybody who lives in London will probably have seen it. It was one of the. It was the tallest building in London in the 18th for quite a while. It was one of the first skyscrapers.
So it's in the middle of Bloomsbury, sort of behind the British Museum.
It is, and it was taken over during the Second World War. By the government as the Centre for Information, Propaganda and Censorship. And Orwell's wife actually worked in the censorship department.
Uh-huh.
So that's a connection. And there is a room 101 there. I haven't been in.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So whose initiative is this project? Who sort of kick-started this whole thing? I mean, were you invited or did people apply or how did it come about?
I was told about it by an old friend of mine, Andrew Chandler, who is systems librarian there. Said they had this. She told me they had this program of visiting sound artists. So I put myself forward, and luckily they said yes.
Yeah. So you had you presumably had a CV as a sound artist before this project. Then, I mean, apart from your career within the Alabama 3 and so on, I imagine you must have had other.
Yeah, it's been a kind of sideline over the years. I've done various things and various projects, and been quietly kind of. Ploughing my little narrow furrow to do with mostly around speech and the spoken word and manipulating speech in various digital ways.
Right.
I've got an early piece I could play you if you like.
Yeah. So what is this one?
Which one shall I play you? Okay, this is one based on Dylan Thomas called The Nightingale Machine.
Listen. The nightingale is burning. Listen. The nightingale is twisting on racks in the coal black sky. The nightingale is my metaphor. The nightingale is a quiet gentleman, and his nameless need is war. Listen. Listen. Time sings through the intricately dead snowdrop. Time sings through the intricately dead snowdrop. Dead. Time dead sings dead through the intricately.
So when did you create that one?
When did I do that? I guess it must have been maybe 10 years ago.
Oh, okay. So it obviously predates this present.
You can tell by the technology. It's pretty pretty glitchy and crackly. I kind of like it like that. Mm. But that's just with an old EMU sampler and a keyboard.
Right.
You know. I had tapes of the complete works of Dylan Thomas, which I really loved. And it just thought it'd be interesting to make a new Dylan Thomas poem out of the old ones.
Yeah.
Fake a Dylan Thomas, make a Dylan Thomas machine almost, you know. And And yeah, and just ended up getting caught up in these loops and things and just making this piece.
Yeah.
Something about Dylan Thomas's voice that is perfect about this. A lot of people I play it to really don't hate it because they didn't like the sound of his voice. They thought he sounded pompous and posh and English. But I love that kind of, because it's a fake voice. He was Welsh, he's from the Valleys, but he's turned himself into this kind of English gentleman, you know. And it's very over the top, but it's perfect for kind of speech based sound art because the voice is so rich and so expressive, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So how does this lead on to the Radical Voices project in some way, or
it does? Before I get into that, I'd like to place another Dylan Thomas piece, just because it's nice because it's kind of 10 years later and it's similar but different. It's a lot more kind of streamlined and sort of simple in its execution. It's half an hour long, so so get comfortable. Well,
all right. Well, we could always talk over the top of it, we'll make a start with that one.
Okay, actually, starts.
Do they have titles? Or?
This one's called Craft or Art, and it's based on one short poem by Dylan Thomas. That's actually the wrong file.
All right.
So that's been mislabeled, so we can't play that. Let's move on to something else.
Okay. All right. So, this takes place, your installation, such as it is, if I can call it an installation, takes place in the Beveridge Hall, is that right?
Beveridge Hall, which is downstairs on the ground floor of Senate House. Yeah.
And is it sort of open to the public? I mean, can people come along and see what you're doing, or is it do they have to wait until you do a performance or something?
I have an open studio every Wednesday. On the fourth floor in the actual library itself, I've got a little office, a little glass fronted office.
Right.
I feel like some kind of exotic fish in a tank.
Yeah.
People come and gawp at me.
Do they?
I try and encourage them to come in, but they just
gawp.
Most of them just kind of gawp and then
stare and think, what's going on in there? What have you got in there, in this glass box?
Loads of old tapes, loads of old CDs, stuff I found in the library, stuff donated by Ron Heisler.
So are you supposed to be creating something as a result of being in the library? So you use the material that's available to you in the library itself?
Yeah, and as a response to this exhibition, the Radical Voices exhibition.
Okay.
As a sound artist, it's been there's not actually not an awful lot of audiovisual stuff in the library, and so not specifically related to the period covered by this exhibition,
right?
Which the most modern exhibits are around the early 80s, and there aren't a lot of very good high quality audio sources to work with after 1982, of course. When it gets into the 90s, there's a sudden leap in the quality of things.
Right.
But luckily, Ron Heisler, the gentleman we mentioned before, who's donated a lot of the pamphlets to the exhibition, also had a small collection of CDs and albums and tapes related to his dissident activities. And I managed to make good use of those.
Does he have his own recordings? I mean, did he make recordings himself, or are they just sort of, pre-recorded stuff?
No, it's stuff he's found or collected. Okay. Or there are some tapes of lectures on materialist and Marxist and anarchist themes.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he took them himself, but they're on tapes, and I've been terrified every time I've played one of these tapes because how fragile. They're going to snap, and I'll have destroyed an important part of political history.
Yeah,
That hasn't happened yet. Luckily, there were a few CDs as well, so I've been mainly using the CDs.
So, as you're working in this library, the library is continuing to function whilst you're there. So the people come and go, but you have to have a special pass, I presume.
I have a special pass. Yeah.
The people as well. I mean, it's only open to students, apart from on a Wednesday. Is that right? Or can people come and use the library?
Yes,
But they have to be students of Senate House or.
You can, even if you're not a student, anybody can use Senate House Library.
Oh, okay.
You have to be a student to borrow the books.
Right,
but if you just want to come in and read the books, anybody, it's open to anybody. Yeah.
Okay, right. Interesting. I mean, I'll just drop in as a matter of... It just so happens that... Do you know the Richard Saltoun Gallery on... I think it's on...
I do. Where is it? I know. Yes, I know it quite well.
Yeah. Right. And they presently have an exhibition on, don't they, of concrete poetry, possibly concrete and sound poetry, I'm not sure. But it includes things like Bob Cobbing, John Furnival, Dom Sylvester, Huedard and so on.
That's right, yeah.
By coincidence, that just happens to be on, it's not a million miles away from Senate House.
That's right, and actually that's quite a nice link there.
Oh, cool.
Because Bob Cobbing, who was it the Writers' Forum Workshop?
Yeah.
He was an important and innovative and avant-garde sound poet.
Yeah.
And one of his protégés and pupils there was a poet that I'll be working with.
Oh, yes.
At the performance for this Radical Voices.
Not Lawrence Upton. Thing.
It's not Lawrence Upton, no. It's a guy called Sean Bonney.
Ah, okay.
Okay, yeah, I should say at this point that there will be a performance this coming Thursday at Senate House.
You mean next Thursday?
Yes.
Oh, yes, because it's Friday now. Sorry, yes, you're right. Next Thursday, then.
Yeah.
Which will be March the...
March the 2nd.
Right.
It's called Radical Sounds. It's part of the Radical Voices exhibition, and that will be the first kind of culmination of the work I've been doing in my residency at Senate House.
Okay. Oh, right. Okay.
And it's going to be amazing. It's going just going to blow your mind.
Right.
Really. It's going to... can change your political preconceptions beyond anything.
Really?
Yeah, it's probably going to change the entire world, actually.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, talk it up a bit.
I think I'm doing it down.
This is March the 2nd at Senate House Library.
Yeah.
What time?
6 till 8.
6 till 8, okay.
Yeah, it's free, but booking is advised. If you type in Senate House Radical Sounds, you'll get the link. Book a ticket, come along, and there's also free wine.
Amazing.
Yeah,
okay.
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So do you want to play something relating to this, or what's your next choice?
Well, I was just talking about Sean Bonney, so why don't we play a bit of...
Okay.
This is actually a piece I did with... which one shall I play? I don't know, they're both so good. Hang on. I'll play this one, just because it's so brilliant. This is Sean Bonney... who will be performing at Radical Voices, and it's called A Hex Against Ian Duncan Smith.
Been hoping to spare you any further musings I might have had on the nature of Ian Duncan Smith, that talking claw. Been hoping to spare you any further musings I might have had on the nature of Ian Duncan Smith, that talking claw.
Well,
okay, I didn't realise that was just a short sample. I'll play the other one.
Okay,
I must have been using that as I must have been trying to make some kind of thing out of him, so I was feeding him into my machines.
Is this Sean Bonney as well? This next one.
This is Sean Bonney. This one's called Letters on Harmony. And this is a version that I played on the wrong show a couple of years ago.
Third letter, unsent. Sorry I've not written for so long. I've been pretty busy, and on top of that, things have been getting rough again. I'm going to have to go on the dole soon, and I'm really not looking forward to it. Don't get me wrong, I don't feel any guilt about it, not at all. The pittance they give us is an insult anyway. It's not even the workfare programmes, it's just that the job centre, the whole process is a nightmare. Years ago, they used to play music in those offices, I don't think they do anymore. It was always the same old predictable crap, yet played just below the standard audibility range. Yeah, I guess that's one way of thinking about the unshielded harmonic condition common to everybody with less than £5 in their pocket. The weird Gnosticism we live inside these days. The social truths that only those who live far below the hunger line have access to. Them, and of course the very rich. As if the rich were some kind of jagged knife out on the social perimeter and we, the very poor, were being scraped against that knife over and over. It's why I get so incensed when you chastise me for the violence in my work. I mean, what do you dream about? My dreams are identical with those of several Tory MPs. Except, of course, I have them when I'm awake. But anyway, whatever. I don't mean to go on about my problems. I'm supposed to be writing to you about music. So let's just think about those songs they used to play in the job centre. All of the latest chart hits converted into a high circular whine. And in the centre of that whine, an all too audible vocabulary. Money, sanctions, threats, etc. That whine, that disaudibility is fascinating. It's supposed to be. To be honest, I'm surprised it's not been taken up by The Wire. I'm surprised there aren't CDs, gigs in the Cafe Otto. I mean, it's a very interesting listening experience. You move in slow motion. You feel like you've just been injected with 300 milligrams of burning dog. Grammar and syntax can no longer be controlled. Speech, which would usually be your means of entry to actual lived time, is compressed and stretched into a network of circles and coils. At its perimeter, a system of scraped negative music, and at its center, a wall. And then you wake up after a night of terrible dreams to find you are that wall. See you soon, I hope. Isn't it about time you had me round for dinner?
Okay, that's Sean Bonney. He'll be reading at the Radical Sounds performance for Radical Voices on Thursday.
Next Thursday, March the 2nd.
March the 2nd, yeah.
I have quick notes here. I've got some notes here. Sean Bonney is a contemporary English poet writing from an anarchist tradition. Bonney's work is by turns excoriating, visionary and apocalyptic. His publications include Notes on Heresy, Poisons, Baudelaire in English, etc. He edits the press YT Communication with Francis Crook. And he had a connection then with Cobbing. So he was a sort of what, a protege or a
yeah, he was an attendee at the New Writers Forum Workshop.
Writers Forum Workshop. Okay. Right. Which apparently, according to my notes here, his work marks a progression and continuance of the British poetry revival.
That's right.
Okay. And so what's his connection? He happens to be there as well, or he's working with you, or...
He's going to be reading some work that's a response to the exhibition, and as well as some of his earlier work and some of his new work, I presume.
Right, yeah. Right. Okay. And
Hopefully we'll be doing some kind of collaboration. I think I might put him through my machines and see what comes out.
Yeah. All right. And then we have another person here in my notebook. Is it Nat Raha?
That's correct, yeah.
Nat Raha is a poet, queer, trans activist based in Edinburgh, Scotland. She is a PhD candidate at the University of Sussex, working on sexuality and gender, critical theory and contemporary poetry and poetics. How does she fit into this?
She's a friend of Sean's, and she's read it. She's read with Sean on many occasions, and she's coming from a similar point of view. It's quite an unusual position that she's writing about gender theory from a Marxist perspective.
Right.
And I'll be very interested to see what she comes up with.
Is she also involved in this event on March the 2nd?
She'll be reading as well.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. And she's going to be doing something interesting with a loop pedal. So I'm hoping that both me, Sean, and Nat can come up with some kind of trielectric, electric melange that will change the face of Western capitalism.
And are you performing actually in the library? Or where does this performance take place?
It's in Beveridge Hall, which is it's a very moody kind of 1984 feeling room downstairs. Okay. Used to be where they used to have the press conferences during World War II.
Yeah.
And interestingly, in the basement there used to be a whole team of censors and eavesdroppers, kind of checking the Orwellian flow.
So
you know,
great ambience for what's going on there.
Hopefully, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you, as a matter of it, you enter from the Russell Square side or from the Gower Street side?
The way I think about it is it's basically behind the British Museum.
Yeah.
So I usually, when I go into the library when I go to work, as it were.
You see, I won't finish until 6:30 on Thursday, right. So I'm going to have to dash to get there. So I don't want to waste 10 minutes sort of working my way around the building.
Right.
How do I get in?
I would go straight through the entrance of the British Museum and then quickly walk through 5,000 years of history.
Right.
And end up...
on that side, on the British Museum side. You can't get in that way, surely.
Yeah, you just go in the front and you just walk through the museum straight in a straight line.
Okay.
And you come out the back.
Yeah.
And then you come out by the cafe
of
Senate House.
Okay.
You go in there, turn left, into the elevator.
Yeah.
Press the button.
And you're into the eavesdropping room.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So what's next on the agenda?
Okay, well, why don't I play this? This is the first piece that I made based on Senate House, and it's actually based on Hannah Thompson's recordings, ambient recordings of sounds within the library. Okay.
Bloomsbury. Easily accessible by air, rail, underground, and other public transport. Building clad in Portland stone. Staff take huge pride in the great national student survey scores, which currently see 96% satisfaction rates. A short walk from hotels.
Okay, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guest is Orlando Harrison, sound artist, presently artist in residence at Senate House Library. This is a piece by Orlando Harrison based on works by Hannah Thompson or some of her recordings?
It's sounds that she's collected. She was the previous artist in residence, and it's based on ambient sounds she's collected in the library. Yeah, the main sound is the sound of an electronic gate that you have to go in to enter the actual library itself, which I've transmogrified using software called Composer's Desktop Project,
right?
CDP, which is a program for the manipulation of audio devised by the electric acoustic composer Trevor Wishart.
Oh, yeah, right. So are all the pieces that all, you know, the contributors, Hannah Thompson, yourself, is it Nat Rahar
and Sean Bonney.
And Sean Bonney, you're all working around the idea of radical voices in some way.
Yeah. Hannah, not so much. Her work was more based on the actual library itself as a building.
Okay.
But obviously politics always comes into it, especially with an institution like Senate House, which is kind of so iconic and is the site of so much valuable information. One of the things working on this project I've had to negotiate is the various political forces pushing and pulling in this very kind of important institution.
Right. You mean the politics within the library, or
within the library and without affecting the library?
Okay. Which are the radical voices? Can you give me some of the examples of the radical voices which are included in the
exhibition?
Yeah.
Well, you've got people like William Beveridge. Is a key. He was one of the architects.
I'm going to interrupt you there because from your blog, it says to turn the Right Honourable Baron William Beveridge, principal architect of the post-war welfare state, into a mutant chipmunk from space might come across as flippant. Expand. That's because you've used his voice in some way?
Well, actually, I ended up not using William Beveridge, partly for that reason. I mean, it's in my previous work, especially with The Wrong Show, most of the stuff I've done has been kind of satirical, so I've got, I've maybe chosen subjects that are ripe for being transformed in some grotesque way, you know.
Right.
A lot of these figures are very important, or they have a lot of historical weight behind them, or have a lot of ideological implications, which means you have to be a lot more careful with what you do with these voices, because there's one piece I've been trying to make about Andrew Dworkin, and a figure like that is so loaded that I feel like any way in which I sort of try and change her or kind of affect the interpretation of what she says through sound, it's so easy to get into difficult territory. I tried slowing her down. This piece that was based on a High Court testimony against pornography, I tried slowing the voice down, and it ended up sounding kind of erotic. She sounded very breathy and kind of, and I thought this feels wrong.
Okay,
and,
right.
I found with a lot of these subjects, doing a piece about Bobby Seale. It's very inflammatory material. Whatever you try and do, suddenly it's very easy to find yourself in very difficult political, ideological territory, which has actually been one of the interesting things about it.
Yeah. And your performance takes place in the Beveridge Hall,
as a
matter of coincidence, perhaps. Again, from your blog, and even the upright Baron Beveridge had a dark side. He, along with many other post-Victorian ideologues, including G.K. Chesterton, Bertrand Russell, John Maynard Keynes, was an advocate of eugenics. And my initial researches uncover the uncomfortable fact that Beveridge recommended that the unemployable be prevented from reproducing.
This is correct. We have to remember, at the time it was in the air, you know. This was just post-Darwin. People were trying to sort out the social problems of the world.
Right.
And they were doing it from a kind of top-down perspective. What must we do about the working classes, you know? And they were kind of viewing it almost in the same way as agriculture. And even someone like Beveridge, who was a liberal and who was kind of, Victorian patrician figure who genuinely wanted to ameliorate the condition of the poor and the working classes, seemed to think that he had a right, or the society had a right, to interfere in the actual kind of reproduction.
Right.
We know where that ended up, you know.
Mm.
But, you know, even now, it's not, you know, people thinking along the same lines now. They're just not calling it eugenics. You know, they're using different strategies.
So, we don't have much time left, Orlando.
Okay.
What else do you want to play? Is there something else we should
play? Okay, well, I should play one piece. I should play a bit of one of the pieces that I'm going to be doing at Senate House on Thursday, March the 2nd.
Will we have time for the Andrea Dworkin piece? Or
I'll give you a little bit of Andrea Dworkin.
Should we do that now?
Okay. Let's do it.
Here's Andrea Dworkin. And of legislation recognizing pornography as a violation of the civil rights of women.
Thank you very much. My name is Andrea Dworkin. I am a citizen of the United States. And in this country where I live, every year, millions and millions of pictures are made of women with our legs spread. We're called beaver, we're called pussy. Our genitals are tied up and pasted. Makeup is put on.
We're called beaver, we're called pussy. Our genitals are tied up, they're pasted. Makeup is put on them to make them pop out of the page.
Is the manipulation of the recording, is that from...
Millions and millions of pictures are made of us.
Is this what you've done with the material?
In postures of submission and sexual access, so that our vaginas are
place, and the major motif of pornography as a form of entertainment is that women are raped and violated like any other we ask for. In the country where I live as a citizen, women are penetrated by objects for public entertainment. Women are urinated.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, pretty strong stuff. It's quite difficult working with that material and producing something that's not... that. You don't feel somehow doing an injustice to the subject itself. You know? So I just want to play out with one of the things I'm going to be doing.
Okay.
At Senate House.
Well, thanks very much to Orlando Harrison for coming into Wavelength this afternoon. Artist in residence at the Senate House Library, performing next Thursday, March the 2nd, between 6 and 8 o'clock. Should we call it a poetry performance?
It's all kinds of things. It's going to be film, poetry, and electronics and music. And
so it's you, Sean Bonney.
And Nat Rahar.
Nat Rahar.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Orlando, for coming in.
Thank you.
And I shall try and get to that event, but I'm going to have to dash. What should we finish up with today?
This is my piece based on a speech by Nye Bevan talking about the Suez Crisis in 1956.
It's a sad story that is unfolding itself before our eyes at the present time. It's a sad story. A very, very sad one indeed. I myself feel despondent about the situation into which we have been got. Really despondent. When some young Tories say, we are giving the lead. The lead to where?
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 Where? Where? Where? Where?